Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for October the 4th, 2012. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
Well, Bobby and I were just talking about it. We're doing pretty good, guy. How are you?
Doing great. Is it me, or does it seem like we've been off for more than just a week?
It seems longer than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Are you running from any alligators down there where you are? They got alligators down there.
I haven't seen an alligator yet, and if I do, I hope he's on a plate. That's the only way I want to see one.
How long are you enslaved there?
I am here until October the 24th. Almost 3 weeks. Yeah.
You're at the end of the earth.
This is as far west as the show has ever been. And we haven't been here in 30 years, so it's all new to people here. So I'm hoping
that's
we do well. There's nothing to compete with here, I can tell you that. So we're far enough away from New Orleans where we don't have to worry about that. We're doing shows on in Metairie the weekend before they jump to me, and then I've got shows on Monday and Tuesday. So hopefully, other than Monday night football, hopefully the Saints won't be playing Monday night football and we'll draw crowds.
Well, I hope that the circus can find their way down there. That's a snake trail down there.
Yeah, it's not actually not bad. It's a nice little town from what I've driven around and seen so far.
I'm talking about just getting to it.
Yeah, it is a little bit. And let me tell you, I stopped in Mobile on my way down when I left Oakland. I stopped in Mobile. I came in the day I came in. It was raining so hard in Mobile, I had to change clothes 3 times loading my car. I guess
really?
Each time.
Oh,
so I waited for it slacked up, and I said, "Okay, this is fine. I'll jump on 10, and you know, I'll just cruise right on in." Well, I sat in bumper to bumper traffic from the minute I got on 10 in Theodore, because there were 3 wrecks right there on the interstate. So I sat in that for 35, 40 minutes. Finally got free, you know, cruised right on through Mississippi. The minute I crossed the Louisiana state line, I thought that it was the return of Katrina. The wind and rain was so bad I couldn't hardly see. So I creeped along about 30 miles an hour off and on most of the way down here from there. I still made it down here a little over 3.5 hours. But I've never seen so much rain in all my life.
Do they actually have a hotel in Houma?
Oh, there's several here. I'm staying in a Days Inn, and there's an extended stay. There's a Quality Inn. There's four or five other hotels right along here. Houma's even got a mall here.
I think Houma, when I was there, had a red light and a gas station.
Was that a regular town down there, Jerry? I heard a lot of people talk about going there, but I never had the pleasure.
Yeah, they ran it pretty regular, Bobby. I bet I was there a year, and I bet I didn't go there 3 times. I stayed up north mostly.
Didn't hurt your feelings, did it?
No, sir. Not when you're in Tulsa the next night.
Oh, jeez.
I left Houma after the matches, and I got home at 3:30 in the morning. I had to leave at 12 the next day to go to Tulsa.
Where were you living in? Shreveport?
Shreveport, right. Maybe that's what's wrong with my knees. It wasn't the wrestling. It was hitting the gas pedal in the
car. Sitting in the car, yeah.
just be glad you weren't driving a clutch back in those days.
Oh, God. Got a body cast by now.
Listen, we Monday of this week, two-part story. I want to pass on our condolences to Gene Bennett and his family. His mom at the young age of 95 left us here last week.
What a life.
I had the privilege of speaking at her memorial service Monday. And we got up and left. We left Atlanta about 7 o'clock to drive over. Had to go to Clanton, Alabama. And it rained so hard on us going to Clanton, Alabama, the animals were standing around in pairs holding hands.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I mean, it was awful. Randy was driving, and Randy's he's never scared me. And I was laying there with my head back on the seat and had my eyes closed, and I felt the car slow down, and I opened my eyes, and I could not see. It was raining that hard. And I knew he couldn't either. And I asked him, I said, "Bud, can you see?" He went, "No." And it was that bad. And it rained all the way over there to just this side of Birmingham. It quit on us. And long day. Long day. But I was very honored to be asked to speak at her service. And it was a good trip. Glad we could go over.
Was that your first trip to Chilton County, Alabama?
That was my first visit to Clanton, Alabama. It was like going back in time. We had lunch at Shoney's, and, you know, they've closed all the Shoney's around here.
Oh, they've opened a Shoney's there
now? Oh, yeah, right there by the interstate. There's a Shoney's Inn and a restaurant.
The only thing in Clanton was, and Gene and I talked about this, and I don't even know if it exists anymore because I never go that far north of Montgomery anymore. But there used to be a place called Tink's Diner. Probably in that same spot where the Shoney's is now, because it was right, literally, you pulled off the interstate, it was right there. That was the only thing in Clanton back in the 70s.
Yeah, we pulled off, one of my philosophical observations, we pulled off the interstate and we turned and we're going down into the, and we were following the GPS and it took us right into the heart of Clanton there, and as you go through and you're looking at the houses. And, you know, I looked over at Randy and I said, you know, I said, buddy, me and you have rode together all over this country. And I said, you know, it don't matter where you go, every town, every little town like that looks the same.
Yep.
They all look the same. You could have just as well have been in the middle of Oklahoma, or you could have been in Georgia or North Carolina, South Carolina, or wherever. They all look the same. And I said that just kind of proves a point that I said we're all alike. We just want to be happy, and wherever you find your happiness, whether it's Tybee Island staring at the beach, which, you know, or sitting in Jackson, Georgia, you know, wherever you are, or in Houma, Louisiana. You know, we just want to be happy. And
I stopped on my way when I left Dothan. I stopped and had lunch with Bill Bowman, and I told him, and I said, I would have never thought I'd ever say this, as much as I don't like the state of Alabama. Never wanted to live there. But I could see myself living in Dothan. Dothan is a nice little, I never spent much time there because I was always there to work and then leave. But that couple of weeks I spent there, I really fell in love with that area. That's a nice area over there. Of course, it's not tied to the island, but, you know, we can't.
Well, maybe you could start running some matches at the farm center.
would you come work for me?
Sure. Better do it for the 23rd.
No, we want him after the 23rd. He'll be able to take them big hip tosses again.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Of course, when he takes a bump, he'll clank.
I asked the doctor what my limitations were going to be. He said, well, you won't ever squat with 300 pounds again. I said, I can't do that now.
Well, and again, I'm glad, Bobby, you brought that up because I had that on my list here to shout out to Gene and his family on the loss of his mother. And I had the pleasure of meeting her a couple of times, and what a nice lady.
Oh, yes. Very opinionated. Stubborn's not the right word. She was one of those people that wanted to do it herself.
Yeah.
She just was very, you know, we were talking the other day. I said, you know, God love her. She had gotten sick here lately, and I said how painful it had to be for her, not only being sick, but people having to do for her when she was so used to doing for everybody else. And got the privilege to meet Gene's family, and you know, I told all of them I wouldn't hold it against them that he was kin to them, and we seemed to get along. So.
Well, we have also this past weekend we lost two members of our fraternity. One of them I knew about when I sent the email out yesterday, which was Bobby Jaggers. But we also, the day before Bobby Jaggers passed away, we lost Ed Pomeroy, who worked with Stan Vachon, Stan Pulaski.
Yeah.
Jeez. Really?
Yes. He was 79 years old.
Good.
What's wrong with him?
Not sure. I think his may have been a heart attack. I don't know that I've even saw what the cause of his death was.
What was wrong with Bobby?
Renal failure.
Really?
And come to find out, and you may have known this, Jay, because you worked with him and everything, he was a Vietnam veteran, and he had been gassed with Agent Orange in Vietnam, and he had developed hepatitis C from that. Has hepatitis C has held just about his entire adult life. And of course, what it does to your kidneys and your liver and everything, that's what eventually what he died of, was renal failure. He was 64.
Mm. I had no idea he was 64.
Yeah, and from what Scott Teal has said, he was supposed to be coming to the reunion that Scott had last weekend and was on his way. And everybody was asking for him, and Eric Emery was there, called him, and called his cell phone, and he said, I was on my way, but now I'm going back to Kansas. And I don't know if that was because he was sick, not feeling well, or what the deal was.
Where did he live?
Dunlop, Kansas, if I'm not mistaken. Somewhere in Kansas, but I think it was Dunlop.
Were you ever around him?
No, I never had the pleasure. Never had the pleasure working with either one of them. I saw Pomeroy some, and well, I've seen Jagger, you know, on videotape, but I saw Pomeroy work a few times live, both in Florida, and he came through Mobile one time.
Bobby, did Jagger ever come here?
Yeah, he was here for a while.
I thought he was.
Yeah, kind of used him kind of middle of the card to the opening matches. Never got a push here, but. He was here for a while.
Bobby was a good hand.
I've heard people over the years say, you know, they couldn't get along with him and different things. I never had a problem with him. He was always very cordial with me. And
he just had some tales to tell.
That kind of stuff you take with a grain of salt.
Oh, absolutely.
Nature of the beast.
It was entertainment, let me put it to you that way.
Where did you work with him, Jerry? In Kansas City?
Yeah, that's where we met him, yeah. He was there quite a while.
Yeah, he kind of split his time between there and I think he went to Portland quite a bit, and he spent quite a bit of time in San Antonio when Blanchard was running. And he bounced around a lot. He was in more places than I realized. I didn't realize. I always thought he was a native. Is that my phone or is that somebody else?
No, that was me. Sorry.
I thought it was pretty long.
My wife handed me a bag and told me to open it, and I was trying to be quiet, and it didn't work.
Your wife to quit interrupting our show? Go to
Michael said, please quit interrupting our show.
Don't tell her I said it. You just tell her.
Well, you, I ain't taking the heat, Bubba. I mean, you're in hot water anyway, so I'm just, it ain't helping. I'm, you know, I'm not hurting anything.
Let's get you out of hot water. I'm in Louisiana, and she doesn't like movies. Oh, man. But I back to Jaggers. He was actually from Washington State. I didn't realize that. He broke in Arizona. He was trained by Tito Montez and Kurt Von Steiger in Phoenix. And I knew he worked under the name Bobby Main, because that's what he worked in Tennessee as. He came with Charlie Fulton quite a bit there and everything. And then, of course, he changed his name to Bobby Jagger. What about Pomeroy? Did either one of you ever work with him?
No, I didn't know.
I saw him a million times, but I never had the pleasure to work with him.
Never. No, he was quite a bit ahead of me. I never was around where he was.
I guess the bulk of his career, of course, he was in Georgia in the late 60s with Butcher, and spent some time in Florida, which is where I saw it, and of course worked all across Canada. He was from Newfoundland, and that's where he always seemed to wind up back there, but he spent quite a bit of time in Omaha, too. Was their top babyface a few years out there when the Omaha office, even though it was part of Gagne's promotion, it was still a kind of separate. And he spent quite a bit of time out there as well. And, of course, I think we mentioned the last show we did by Don Fields. And speaking of which, I listened to Les and Mike last night on their show, and if they want the Welsh family tree explained in detail, all they got to do is invite me to come on their show, and I'll be glad to explain that to them, how all that works and how they're all related and everything. They were struggling with it last night and weren't sure. So if either one of them are listening or listen later on, give me 10 minutes on your show, and I'll explain it all to you.
You can do that in 10 minutes.
It took 4 years of college to figure it out, but
pretty much. I've got it written down somewhere, so all I'm going to do is read it.
Jeez.
Oh, man. But Mike brought up a good point. While one, that family is not talked about more than it is and not recognized more than it is, because for 30, 40 years you couldn't work in the Southeast and not have to deal with a Welsh somewhere along the line.
Did Lee ever work anywhere besides down there?
Yeah, he worked. He worked
in Georgia, some.
Yeah, he worked in Georgia, worked in Florida, not in extended periods. The only place he really worked in any extensive, other than the Gulf Coast, was in Tennessee. He came to Mobile the first time in 1953, and of course Buddy Fuller was running it at that point, the Mobile territory, and then Lee bought him out in December of 59, and of course had to be there. But he would go off periodically to Tennessee. They would go down into Florida. He and Bobby worked as the Blue Infernos and. Florida briefly. They would work over in Georgia primarily for Fred Ward, but there was a close relationship there between the Fields and Fred Ward, because the closest of Columbus to the Dothan end of the territory, well, kind of quite a bit. A lot of the same guys worked both territories, and he started in Oklahoma, because that's where he was from, where all of the Welsh were from originally. But spent time there. And that's the only places I know of course, you know, owning it there to the Mobile territory. And he was the biggest thing down there from the mid-50s until he sold it. He could still, you know, work and sell tickets. So, no really any need to go anywhere else.
Did he just lose interest in it down there?
Well, he bought the racetrack in 1972 or 73, and that started, he was splitting his time between that, and he was less and less involved with the wrestling and letting Rocky McGuire run in one end and Bob Kelly run the other end, and he just got less and less involved because the racetrack took up so much of his time. And then there towards the end, the territory was starting to die, and you know, he had worked out the deal with with Jim Barnett, and that fell through, and then we sold it to Ron Fuller. But there, by the last year that they were there, they had lost television, their main television. So in 76, they were taping the Mobile house shows, and the production was not good. The television program, and it bounced around so much, it didn't have a permanent spot. They just stuck it wherever, you know, Channel 5 would put it. And it's a shame that that's all that pretty much that exists for the bulk of Gulf Coast Wrestling on video is that stuff from Mobile Ohio shows in 76. There's a little bit of Dothan out there and just a snippet of the Mississippi stuff, but those programs were so much better, the studio program. And it just slowly died, and it was time to get out. I think Lee was just burnt out on it, and he'd been running that territory for 17, 18 years by that point.
Well, it was good to him, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Very good to him. So was that racetrack.
He had the racetrack till he died.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
Miss Ida has it now.
Yep.
In the drag strip.
No, Tom.
When was it, Michael, we were there that they had the NASCAR drivers coming in? 5 years ago?
Something like that, yeah.
There was a Saturday night where they had a couple of the NASCAR drivers, or maybe three or four of them, were coming in to do an autograph signing, and they were also going to drive somebody's car in a shootout or some kind of special race or something where they were going to race each other. And, son, you talk about it rained all day. I mean, it rained. It rained so hard that, you know, there's a tin roof on that building we had the reunion in. It rained so hard you couldn't hear the PA system for the rain hitting the roof. And it leaked so bad down there we had buckets sitting all over the tables. I mean, it was awful. But that racetrack, with all that rain coming down, and the probability of it being rained out was probably 95%. That racetrack filled up, and you've been there, Jerry. You know how far it is from the racetrack back up to that main road.
Right.
They were backed up all the way back to that main road and turned out across the railroad tracks back out on 92 there, trying to get into place. And it was already full, and there was that many more on the way. So that's a hotbed of that racing down there.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
He never tried putting on any wrestling matches at the racetrack, Michael?
Not that I'm aware. No. I think he tried to. He kept that as separate as he could. Now he and a lot of the guys raced for him. Lee raced himself.
Okay.
Kelly Ford. And I don't know if Kelly was the booker for the racers or not, but he won quite a few.
Yeah. Well, they had, in Atlanta, Paul Jones. He had some points in the Atlanta International Raceway.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, back in they used to hold their stockholders meeting at the sports arena once a year. They'd come in, set up down there, and just set some chairs up and have their stockholders meeting. But if you look back at results from Atlanta wrestling, this must have been, and I'm guessing now because I don't remember the year. We're talking 65, 66, somewhere in there. They had a tournament for the Georgia Heavyweight Championship because they had never had a Georgia Heavyweight Champion. And the blow-off for the thing was the finals of the tournament was Sputnik Monroe against Dick the Bruiser. And they actually had the match on a Sunday afternoon at the Atlanta International Racetrack.
Wow. I knew that match, but for some reason I was thinking that was at...
Well, Rich had it on his website. He had it listed as Lakewood Fairgrounds at that raceway out there at Lakewood Park that used to be here in Atlanta, but it was not. It was held in Hampton at that racetrack down there.
I knew they had matches at Lakewood, but I was thinking that was it. What was the name of the ballpark that used to be out there on
Postoleon? No. This one was done. That was done. That was the only time I ever knowed them to run out there, but they did that on a Sunday afternoon at that racetrack.
Wow. Which that racetrack has changed so much over the years.
Oh yeah, and it changed hands. But I went to one show there as a kid. I saw Rocca wrestle Sputnik Monroe at Postoleon Ballpark. It held a lot of people, but the sight lines were horrible. You were so far away from the ring because they'd set the ring up on the pitcher's mound, and then they'd put chairs all around the ring for ringside. And then if you sit in general admission where we sit, you were so far from the ring. It was just it wasn't a great place to. I mean, I'm sure they were doing it to sell tickets, but they couldn't get that auditorium on certain days because of the circus and Holiday on Ice and different things that they got priority. But
well, the longest home run in history was hit at Postoleon Park. Doug.
Oh, that's one that landed in the train car.
I went to Chattanooga. Got hit a home run on a wide open Chattanooga. How about that for something to brag about?
That used to be a big deal. I mean, I can remember as a kid, I saw the Crackers play there a time or two. It was a big deal, man, for somebody to hit that ball over that right field wall up on the train tracks. That was a pretty good shot.
Oh, man. But I was on at Hampton. The first time I ever went to Hampton, I had just moved to Atlanta and had been there not quite a year. It was the summer of, it was July 4th of 1983. Willie Nelson decided to have one of his annual 4th of July picnics out there with 150 different acts and all day long thing. And I foolishly thought, well, let's go to that. So the lady that eventually became my wife, and now my ex-wife, we were living in Marietta at the time, so we decided we'll go to Hampton and go to 4th of July. When we got there, I think everything started around 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, something like that. We got there just as the opening act was coming on. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Hank Williams Jr. It was so hot out there, I made it through three acts, and I thought, well, I just can't take this anymore. Let's go back into Griffin and see if we can't find some place to go grab something to eat or something and just, you know, let the sun go down and we'll come back because, we, you know, our hands were stamped. We'll come back in. We found a little movie theater in Griffin and went and saw Stroker Ace. I'll never forget it. Worst movie I've ever seen in my life. And, but that air conditioner felt so good in there, I wasn't complaining. So I thought, well, when we came out, the sun was starting to go down a little bit. I said, well, let's just look at going back out there. And I looked at my skin, and I was red as a lobster. And I said, nope, that's it. We're going to lie out. So we drove back to Marietta and saw three acts of it. Never saw Willie Nelson that day. God, I would never make that mistake again. That was the hottest I've ever been in my life.
Jerry, did you guys ever run when you were, I know I never did working for Fred, but did you ever run what was it, Golden Park, the baseball field?
Yeah.
Did you? How about the football stadium next door on the other side?
Well, there too, yeah.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we ran both times I worked both of those things. That was when I was working for Ann, when Dickie was promoting down there. But you know how we've talked about this, how things stand out in your mind, and you just remember something so vividly. I can remember working in that football stadium, and the baby faces were dressing somewhere up near the front of the stadium. I can't remember exactly where, but it was a short walk to the ring, and the heels were dressing on the other end of the stadium. I mean, it was 100 yards. Down on the other end, you had to walk all the way across the football field. And I remember going to the ring that night to referee, and the first time I ever met him was Tarzan Tyler. And I can remember Dickie getting on the microphone and introducing him and giving him this huge buildup about one of the most dangerous men in wrestling and blah, 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 blah. But I can remember that guy walking across that football field, and son, he just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
He was a big man.
And it was the first time I'd ever met him was when we stepped in the ring that night, and we come to the center of the ring. And he just, I mean, he wore pink boots, and he had those checkered colored trunks. I never seen anybody else wear any like that. Luke Graham had a pair, but they were different than his. And this guy, he was one of those people that always had a tan and had that hair bleached blonde, and it was impeccable. I mean, it was just, I can still see him coming across that field.
He was a monster.
Yes, he was. And when he, I never worked with him, but he seemed like he was a heck of a worker when he was in that ring.
He really was.
I mean,
he
just.
Well, man, yeah. That size, man, please.
And, buddy, he looked the part.
He did. He was an impressive-looking man.
And he had a long career, too. He had a long career. He was still working when he was I don't know if he was wrestling or just managing, but he was still in the business. He was still in that car there. Well, before we get off into our subject for the evening, I've got a call on the line from K334. If I'm not mistaken, that's Pilton. Maybe it's Charlie Platt or somebody I owe something to from my stay there a couple of weeks ago. Call from K334. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Dennis Smith from Montgomery, Alabama. How y'all doing tonight?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I want to compliment y'all with that excellent interview y'all did with Charlie Platt. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Charlie's a wonderful guy. He's a wonderful
guy.
Yeah,
he is. And the path, I had the pleasure of meeting him twice before. Yeah, he's a good guy. I think across the nation, in my opinion, I think he's pretty underrated as a wrestling announcer. I appreciate what he did because he cared about his job. Seems like he cared more about his job than Tony Schiavone did. How y'all feel about Tony Schiavone?
I never was all that impressed with him. How about you guys?
I never met Tony.
I never met him. He was a Crockett man, so he did what the Crockett's told him to do. He's still in Atlanta. He is the sports director for WSB Radio here in Atlanta.
Really?
Man.
Yeah, and I hear him several times a week when I'm thumbing through the radio, you know, reporting on sports. But he's still here in Atlanta.
That's a good point. And I got to where towards the end of WCW before Vince bought it out. I couldn't watch the show. But then again, Tony was only doing what he was told to do. But in the early days, when the Crockett's first bought out. I guess it was Ole, and started running on TBS. I could appreciate Tony so much more because David Crockett, I never could get into him. He was too marked, in my opinion, for lack of a better term. Tony brought a bit of an even keel to it, and he seemed a little bit more straight forward and, you know, trying to make it sound like a true sport. But as time went on and when WCW got more and more and more involved, especially when all that NWO stuff, and that's about the time I quit following it, he had gotten, you know, he was totally ignoring everything that was happening in the ring, and all he was talking about was the next pay-per-view. But then again, he was following somebody's direction, so... even though I never cared for him at that point, you know, probably wasn't his fault the way he called a match.
Yeah. Well, guys, I appreciate you. Have a good night. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Thanks for calling. You know, I think we're a little skewed. Jerry, myself, you, we had guys like Charlie Platt, Gordon Solie, Les Thatcher. You know, and these guys that came along after, I mean, we can't help but compare them to what we knew. And but these, you know, those guys, the newer guys, don't hold a candle.
No.
Jim
Ross is as close to what we used to have as anybody I've ever heard.
Yeah. And even there, he had his moments. Of course, I mean, he was only saying what was said to him in his earpiece. But announcers, in my opinion, that a lot of people don't discuss and don't talk a lot about. And you guys were familiar with them as Jim Carlisle in Columbus. He had a great voice, and I thought he was good. And Bob Caudle for the Crockett's, I thought was very good.
Yeah. You know, you talked about what they're hearing in their ear. You know, when you were doing it by the seat of your pants.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, Jerry's done interviews, and Jerry, did you ever try to do any play-by-play with anybody? Did they ever stick you out there to?
I did some out there for Watts.
Oh, okay. It's not the easiest thing in the world to
do. No, sir, it's not.
It's not. I mean, you know, it's just you. We did a deal in Atlanta, and, God, I wish I could find a copy of the tape, but it probably don't exist. We did a deal in Atlanta where, you know, in all the years we had been doing the show, Gordon Solie had never been touched. And we did a deal about 45 minutes into the show, maybe 50 minutes into the show, where in an interview with Don Morocco, Morocco turned around, and he didn't hit Gordon, but he bumped him and knocked him down. And when they knocked him down, the TV went to black, and we went to a commercial. And when it comes back on, I'm standing out there. And I had to do the last 10 minutes of the big show. And that's the hardest 10 minutes I ever did in my life.
It's not what people think, I'm telling you.
It's, you know, and you're talking to a camera. You're not talking to a human being. And that was one of the hardest things to get used to, was to talking to that camera and make you get your mindset that you're talking to people, not a camera. And it was Les Thornton and somebody had about a 7-minute match I had to do. And then we went on, you know, then I closed the show. But it's not an easy thing to do. And to get comfortable doing it and to come across as comfortable and to come across as people's, the voice that people like to hear or want to hear, man, that's an accomplishment.
And that's the thing, you know, for how many years is, you know, I know it's popular now to have a two-man team calling matches, but how many years did Gordon Sully do it by himself?
Oh.
You know, 2 hours. By himself. 2 hours in Tampa. By himself.
Ed Capel.
Yeah, Ed Capel. Exactly.
And we've talked about him. He had that little catchphrase that drove people crazy. But even the guy in the Macon, people. You know, I mean, he became the voice of Macon TV. You know, and you mentioned Jim Carlisle. Jim Carlisle was a great wrestling announcer.
Very good.
Jim Carlisle come across as being intimidated a little bit and being meek, and that's because that's exactly what he was meek and intimidated. I mean, I was always afraid he's going to have a stroke or something.
You know, Vin Scully still does the Dodgers by himself.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
And Zardy said he's coming back next year, but he's only doing home games next year.
What's he, 85 now, Bobby?
Something like that.
He still sounds the same.
He's got to be older than that. Is that all? I would think he would be in his 90s by now, because he was calling Dodger baseball back in the 50s and 60s, wasn't he?
I thought they said he was 80. Maybe he is older. I don't know. I don't know.
Jerry, I don't know if you were there or not. Let me throw one Jim Carlisle story in on you. Jim was always very nervous doing interviews and around the guys, because the guys were so much bigger than he was. I mean, he was, you know, Jim was a guy that came out of TV, went to work for Mr. Ward. He sat right there in the middle of all of that stuff, and he had to deal with Ralph, he had to deal with Leon, he had to deal with Rose, he had to deal with Mr. Ward. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but he's in the middle of he was the outsider in a family-run business, and he was always very, you know. So we're at the TV there in Columbus one Saturday, and Bill Eady took a pair of scissors and stuck them in his jacket pocket, and he went out to do an interview. And he got to talking about what he was going to do to somebody. It might have been Tommy Rich. Maybe it was a hair match or something. I can't remember what the deal was. But he pulled these scissors out, and he reached over, and he cut Jim Carlisle's tie in half. I mean, just lopped it off. And the look on Jim Carlisle's face was priceless. And you get Bill Eady to tell you the story. He said it was the hardest thing he ever did, to keep a straight face and not bust out laughing when Carlisle looked at him.
Oh, don't you know he freaked out?
Oh, gee, like I say, I thought he was going to have a stroke at some point. But there, you know, we've talked about this before too, but going along that same vein about the announcers and whatever, you know, Mr. Ward, that old hello to my sick and shut-in friends,
but
and the Shriners hat.
Did you know
and
that?
All of that stuff. People were comfortable with that stuff, and they believed in him.
You know, and then he would say that, and he would never come back out there.
Nope. He just did a little opening of the show, and that was the end of it.
Every territory had its own little, or every town had its own little quirk to it, you know?
Yep.
Was you ever around, either one of you around Boyd Pierce?
I was just about to bring him up. I never was. Watched him a million times. Bobby, did you ever see anything with Boyd Pierce?
You know, I talked to him on the phone one time about something.
I don't even
remember what that was about when I was working in the office, but I never met him.
He was a hoot. He used to do TV in Shreveport. He lived in Dallas. But
Was it Dallas or Houston? Wasn't he with he started out with Boss. Didn't he own like a clothing store or something where he got all those wild clothes?
Oh, he had the wildest clothes I've ever seen. I thought he lived in Dallas. Maybe he did live in Houston. I don't know. But
he started with Paul Boss. He was renting the house announcer in Houston for many, many years and probably did Houston TV as well before he came with Watts.
Oh, he was good. Now, I don't think he wasn't.
Yeah, he was.
He was
one of those that you just look forward to hearing him just because he was so entertaining just to listen to another one.
How many people do you think watched every week just to see what he was going to have on?
Oh, please.
It was his gimmick.
Oh, exactly. And it fit him to a T. You know, that was his thing, you know.
Yeah, and somebody else couldn't. I mean, you know, it wasn't a funny ha-ha thing. It was what he was. If somebody else had tried that, it wouldn't have come off the same way. It was just
like an idiot.
Yeah. Looked like Speck Rhodes on the Porter Wagner show.
Exactly.
Well, when Lynn Tony did television wrestling in Pensacola, he always had on a bright yellow, bright green, some sort of wild colored sports coat. But there again, you know, it was not. Lynn was a former radio disc jockey. He was did big band stuff back in the 40s and in the 60s. Same time he started doing wrestling, he hosted a kiddie show where he wore a tiger outfit and tiger ears. But there again, you know, he wasn't an expert on wrestling, didn't know the holds, but he put the emphasis on what was going on in the ring, and he, you know, it's what people were comfortable with. I don't know if you guys ever saw Jim Hess that did Knoxville prior to less knowing it for Ron Fuller, but Jim Hess was the Knoxville television commentator for John Cusano for many, many years, and I don't think he ever knew the name of a proper name for hold, but he was just entertaining to listen to him. He loved to argue with Ron Wright. That's what people wanted to see, you know. That's what so many people don't understand about the territory days and everything, how, you know, these guys were your hometown heroes. The announcers were like members of your family, and you were living vicariously through, you know, what you were seeing on television, whether it was your favorite babyface wrestler or the announcer or whatever it was, and that's what drew people. And I don't see how anybody can get that feeling from a paper.
No, absolutely not.
Anyway, well, back onto the subject what I wanted to talk about tonight.
Hang on a minute.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's back up a second before you get started. You said something there, and you know, Wednesday nights to Jerry in Columbus was the night he looked forward to because he knew he was going to see the wrestling matches. He was going to be there. He was going to be part of it. You're right. You live vicariously through them. You live and die with your heroes, you know, whoever they are. You know, it was, you know, you could be a John Wayne fan, but you never saw John Wayne. But if you liked, The Butcher Vachon, you could see him every Wednesday night in Columbus. You know, these pay-per-views are today's people's house shows. I mean, we got folks, and I know people, that look forward to these pay-per-views like I used to look forward to the City Auditorium in Atlanta.
You couldn't wait to get there, could you?
Could not. Listen, the doors opened at 6:30. I would go to the drugstore and buy whatever I could find, Wrestling Review, whatever magazine I could find. And if I couldn't find that, I'd buy Mad Magazine. And at 6:30, when the doors opened, I would go up to where I sit every week, and I'd sit there and I'd read my magazine waiting on 8:30. Now, I could just as easily have stayed home till 7:30 and went up there about 8 o'clock, but I couldn't wait. I mean, I waited all week for this.
Exactly.
But, you know, these people today, these pay-per-views are their house shows. And they get excited over them, but you know, they just don't know, and it's not their fault, I don't guess, but they just don't know what it was like.
No, not
and
at
I kind of wish I could go back to when I was a kid before I smarted to the business and go
well,
one
you know,
more
it,
time.
It, Bobby, it was the atmosphere of the
oh
the
yeah,
and it was the same, and it was true for me, and I'm sure it was for you guys. You know, most everybody in the first two or three rows of ringside had been coming there forever and ever and
oh,
ever.
Yeah.
You knew they were going to be there. You knew what they were going to draft like. You knew how they were going to react to the matches. I got just as big a kick. Once I started learning and getting smart to the business a little bit, I still went just to watch the crowd.
And you develop. Look, my wife's best friend, and they've been best friends for almost 40 years. They met at the they actually met as a pen pal through one of those wrestling magazines. And they met at the city auditorium. They agreed to both be at the auditorium on a certain date, and they met, and they have been best friends for almost 40 years.
That's unbelievable.
I'm convinced that if it came down to me or her, I'm out of luck. I mean, they're that close. You know, I mean, if Debbie ever chops me up, Dale will be the one to bring the garbage bags and the twist ties. So, you know, I mean, it's just, but that's the kind of camaraderie you developed. And, I mean, I don't know.
I'm hereby putting out a $100 bounty. Anybody that can come up with a wrestling review or any other magazine that has Debbie Hester in it in the pen pal section, I'll give you $100.
Yeah, I heard that. God, what year would that have been? What year did you do the pen pal thing?
Oh, I can tell you that.
What year was it?
I was 14, she was 16, and it
was 1973.
Okay. Well, there it is. Anybody comes up with it, let me know, email me, call me, smoke signals, whatever, I'll give you $100.
Yeah. She's walking away talking, and they were both lucky enough to meet me, and I gave them both a job. They used to both sell tickets for me.
But that was true. I mean, that the atmosphere, I think, and I don't know, and like you said, I guess they don't know any better, but even a lot of the house shows that you know, that you go to for Vince, you know, you're so distant. I mean, everybody, they're not paying attention to hardly what's going on behind them, so, you know, interested in trying to get their face on the jumbo star and get their scene for a side scene or whatever.
Do they stand up at ringside? I can't tell what's going on.
Well, they got chairs, but they don't sit down. They're trying to get on the jumbotron or on TV.
Oh,
well, listen, when they run shows that are not televised, like if you go to a Friday night or a Saturday night or a Sunday night show with Vince, they'll always run two or three shows leading up to wherever they're going to be for that Monday taping. You know, there's no music, there's no, I mean, it's just ring the bell, here we go. Well, my grandson went to Macon, I don't know, him, his mom and my daughter and son-in-law took him to Macon 3 or 4 years ago. And he was so disappointed because he was expecting the fireworks and all this other stuff. And when he got over there, all it was six matches of the people that he had seen on TV. But, you know, now you're telling six guys to go out there. There's no angles. There's no personal issues. Nothing's been geared for this town other than WWE's coming, and here's what you're going to have. You know, he was very disappointed. Now, he went to WrestleMania last year. He's going to the Phillips here for something for the Hell in the Cell pay-per-view or whatever. He's excited about that stuff because he'll get all the gimmicks with it. But, you know, there's just – when you went on Wednesday night, Jerry, you had watched TV the week before or the Wednesday before. They had set something up to pique your curiosity to get you back the next week.
You had to be there.
You couldn't miss it because you're afraid you'd miss something. And that's the same way it was with me. I mean, you know, I got to go see it. And
people really overlook Bobby and Mike. It took brains to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, week in and week out, the same town. I mean, to keep that momentum and curiosity and excitement. And it was just... I guess we took it all for granted even when we was doing what was going on.
Yeah, we did. We did. we had to walk away from it to see it. And I think that's true with a lot of things we do in life. I remember one time about, I was working for Ann, and we ran a show somewhere, and, I mean, there was nobody there. There was, you know, 100 people maybe, small crowd, you know, and I was, you know, I was a kid. I hadn't been working long, and I went out, and I, you know, perfectly honest, I didn't give it 100%. I just went out there and went through the motions, and when the matches were over that night, I sat in the dressing room, and I'll never forget Jody Hamilton telling me this. He said, Bobby, he said, I watched you tonight, and he says, you know, you did your job. He said, but you weren't enthusiastic about it. He said, you weren't enthusiastic because there was nobody out there tonight. He said, you got to remember something. He said, that 100 people out there is the best fans we got. He said, we evidently didn't have anything here tonight these people wanted to see, that they were willing to come out and buy their ticket and come in and see. We evidently didn't have nothing. He said, but that 100 people came anyway. And I never forgot that.
That's very true.
So.
And I think that's a lot of what's missing, you know. And I don't know. I've never followed an independent promotion. The few times I've ever been, I've been with Bobby, and it's, you know, once a year or whatever. But they don't seem to be able to build on anything. I mean, they basically go out and imitate what they see on, you know, what fans want to see that they see on Monday night. And everybody has excuse, and for the most part, it's true that, you know, you can't draw without television. I thought that for a long time, too, and I've realized that it can be done after talking to Joe Turner and Bill Bowman when they, the entire year of 1968, when they would sell out for Whiting Auditorium in Mobile, and you have television. But they drew week after week after week after week with no television. Just people returning the word of mouth of what happened the Wednesday before. So it can be done if you know how to do it. And if you like to Jerry's point, you've got somebody smart enough to know how to put it all together. And I think that's the biggest thing that's missing from the. You don't have Leo Garibaldi's or Louis Tillette's or Frankie Kane's anymore that have a vision that can see, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months down the road, this is where I want to take this. Okay, this is not working. I need to end this and you know, roll this into it. The people just aren't there anymore. Know how to do it. You know, do you guys agree with that or not?
Oh, absolutely.
That's
what churned the whole thing. I know Dickie told me one time he asked Leo, when Leo was booking in Atlanta and just drawing everywhere, and he was just setting it on fire. And he asked him, he said, how do you do this week in and week out? He said, I got good talent. But Leo had a head on him. But you have to have talent to do it with.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's you know, it starts with the man up top, then you got to have something to work with.
Exactly. And he's got to know, okay, these two work well together, these two mesh together, these two can draw together, or these four can draw together, or whatever.
Not just,
you know, okay, this guy's a big name and this guy's a big name. Let's throw them in a ring together week after week after week. Without chemistry, they're not going to draw a dime. You know?
And you got to be flexible, too.
Yes.
I'm sitting here thinking about Garibaldi, and like I said, I never had the privilege. I've just heard a lot of people talk about him and different things. But one thing I remember as a kid, this territory, and, you know, I can sit here and talk like this now, but it was always a singles territory. You know, I mean, you know, it was always Stasiak and Scarpa, or Gunkel and Blassie, or Mario Galento and Buddy Fuller, or whoever was the on top, but it was always singles matches. Well, Garibaldi was smart enough when he laid eyes on the Torres brothers to say, hey, I got something here.
Exactly.
And he got Enrique and Alberto and pushed them on top, and brother, they ran on top for what, a year, year and a half?
Strong.
They started out with the Vachons. They worked through them. They worked through the Red Raiders, which was Dick Dunn and Willie Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
They worked through Lars and Gene Anderson. I mean, they drew a lot of money you know, but it became a tag territory. The top matches started being tag team matches.
And then, you know, they moved Enrique out and brought in Ramon.
Yeah.
And Ramon and Alberto did so well on Columbus television, which bled over into, like Charlie Platt was saying when he was on with us a couple of weeks ago, bled into Dothan, that they brought them into Dothan to work with Joe and Bill and Drew Greathouses, even though Ramon had been there before. But it had been 2 or 3 years since he had been there as a singles. But based on the strength of Columbus and stuff like that, you know, grew from there. And it's just, you know, and talking about great bookers, there's another, Tom Ernesto was, you know, how great he was in many years in Atlanta. Both of you guys worked with him, so you know how good he was.
He was excellent.
But it's a combination, and I guess that, I don't know if that's just what's missing or not in today's thing, because I mean they seem to, once they get guys on the top, you know, they keep pushing the same matches over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, how many times did John Cena work with Big Show or Randy Orton in Big Show? And I mean, Bobby, how well would Sputnik and Rocca do week after week after week? They were both big names, but they didn't have the chemistry.
No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't.
So, you know, that's the secret of it. But anyway.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I just, you know, the flexibility thing, but, you know, I just got to, you triggered a thought there about the pay-per-views and stuff. I think about, you know, they plan for they have parties where they get 10 guys together or 10 couples together, and they split the cost so it doesn't cost as much to get it. And I understand what they're doing and why they do it, and it's all they've got. It's all they've got. Times change. Time marches on. But I sure do feel sorry for these people that will never have the joy of what we had when we had that right here in our own backyard. And like Jerry said, we probably took it for granted. I mean, because I'm like Jerry. I've heard him say it 100 times, and I wholeheartedly agree. I never thought it'd end.
Nothing like an arena, smoke-filled arena, with all the house lights down and that one single light shining on the ring.
Yep.
No commentary. No fireworks, no music, no nothing. Jerry, you've been in Fort Hensley Armory, and I've said this 1,000 times, but just watching Johnny Valentine walk to the ring and seeing the rise he got out of people by doing absolutely nothing other than walking slow to the ring, that was worth the price of admission to me.
Of course it was, Mike. I know when I was running, those guys, turned into music, and I said, okay, we got music. Yeah, I want my music. I said, it doesn't matter what the music is. What are you going to do when the music stops and the bell rings? What can you do then? That's what it's about.
Yeah.
They had lost all concept of what the heck was going on, and I get so frustrated. You know, we talk about it changing, right? I'm sitting here, I'm watching a football game. It's still the same. Baseball's still the same. How this got twisted around and into that, I don't know. I really don't know. I shake my head. I really do.
It's all big money business, and, you know, if the devil is due, Vince has learned how to re-educate fans. And he's the only one that ever learned to do it, because none of the old-time promoters, had they tried, I don't think they... Both of you got to stop thinking about this. Had Ernesto or Barnett or Bram, just all of a sudden, you know, every week somebody's coming out to music and they're getting in the ring and they're doing high spot after high spot after high spot, do you think the fans would have continued to come?
No, I don't.
It would have been too drastic a change. I don't think they would have either.
Yeah.
And but McMahon did it smartly. You know, he slowly re-educated everybody. You know, the way Hulk Hogan worked was the way. Well, New York was a different animal anyway. I mean, they always had the monster babyface champion that you know, really didn't do anything but take a beating until he got mad, and then he beat up everybody in the world. That formula worked with Bruno. They did it with Pedro Morales. Backman a little bit less so because he was an actual wrestler, but that they just took what that the old formula was anyway, and just super amped it up with Hogan, and re-educated everybody that that's what wrestling was about. And give the devil his due. He's made a lot of money at it.
I wonder how he's doing now. Of course, he's not doing anything like when Hogan was there, or Austin was there. He couldn't be. Just couldn't.
No, and
when Austin was there, I watched it every Monday night.
Really?
But, now, I'm going to give him credit. He worked hard in that ring every time I ever saw him. He gave it his all.
I just think that what they've got to work with now are guys who, you know, didn't learn the way that people like Austin learned, the way that, you know, even though I'm not that big a fan of The Rock, but he did learn, you know, the old school way. But their guys now are just, they're brought up there and pushed to the limelight so quick, and they're given a certain number of weeks to get over before they either repackage them or let them go for a while and then bring them back. There's no, you know, it's so hurried up. Everything is so hurried up now. There's no training. I know they got a place in Florida and everything, but that's not like working, you know, 5-6 nights a week in front of a live crowd.
Absolutely.
You know, you slowly work your way up and learn, and then you leave this territory and go to that territory, leave that territory and go to this territory. There's nowhere to do that, no way to do that anymore. And it's not the guy's fault. They don't know. You know, the way we all learn, they're not being taught that way. And you know, the ones calling the shots are Hollywood screenwriters. You know, they're creating characters more than creating angles to build a wrestling program around. So, but anyway. We're all starting to sound like Les Thatcher.
Nothing wrong with that.
No.
Not a bit. I wish I had a thimble full of his knowledge, I tell you. But anyway, what I wanted us to discuss tonight, now that we're halfway through the show, was more so for you two guys, because you guys worked full-time a whole lot longer than I ever did. Just basically, because people know what wrestlers did and referees did and, you know, ring announcers did when you either were on TV or at the house shows, but how did your days go? Bobby, with you, before you started in the office, when you were still a referee or hauling the ring or whatever your duties were, what was a typical day for you?
When I went to work for Ann, when I first went to work for her, before I even started refereeing, my first job with her was traveling 3 days a week with Charlie's brother Jack, who drove the ring truck, and me and Larry Nichols traveled and put the ring up at spot shows. And we sold programs. We kept, you know, whatever we had to do, that was what we did pretty much. So our days at that point in time were pretty well free, unless there was something to do, you know, that the office wanted us to do, whether it be set up a building somewhere, break a building down. I mean, it varied greatly. Once I started refereeing, working for Ann, my days were pretty much, I actually started going to the gym 2 or 3 days a week. That's back when we had there was a European health spa here in Forest Park in Atlanta, and I would go there 2 or 3 days a week. And normally by then it was time to leave because they always wanted to ring there early. And that was pretty much it. It was the same thing every day. It changed very little. When I left there and went to work for Barnett, my deal with Barnett was I helped in the office during the day and I refereed at night. And that meant I was at the office every morning at 9 o'clock. This is the glamorous lifestyle everybody wanted. I was at the office at 9 o'clock every morning. It didn't matter where I was the night before. I was at the office at 9 o'clock, and I stayed at the office until time to leave for the town. And then I either, if I was driving, riding with somebody, or taking the ring, I left, went to the town, worked that night, came back home, caught whatever sleep I could, and back at the office at 9 o'clock the next day.
Now, that was 5 days a week, right?
That was 5 days a week.
Right.
Yeah, when we first started. And then Saturdays, of course, was Atlanta TV and Columbus TV, and then a show that night either in Carrollton or Griffin. And then we weren't running Sundays then. We were Sundays was an off day. So we had one day off a week. And then eventually we started running on Sundays. And 1970, well, I had the bright idea to wrestle, so I left here in whatever year I was down there. You know more than I do. 77?
77, yeah.
Yeah, I went down to Mobile, and I stayed down there about 2.5 weeks and realized that the territory was dying. I wasn't going to be able to make it. I mean, I was used to making decent money up here, and I wasn't going to be able to make it there. And the deal was I was supposed to go there for 2 weeks and then leave, and I was supposed to go to Tennessee. Ernesto was booking there. He called and said that something had happened. He couldn't use me in Tennessee. He wanted me to go to Detroit, and that's when I decided to get out of the business because I wasn't going to Detroit. So I actually got out of business for 8 months. And January of 79, Barnett called me and wanted me to come back and run the ticket office in Atlanta. And I went up and met him, and he said, don't want you to referee. I want you to run my office for me, my ticket office. And I did that for about 6 months, and Doug Smith decided to leave and pursue other interests, and he was Barnett's office manager. So Barnett said, I want you to come back here and work with me for 2 weeks until I can find a replacement. And I said, okay. And I was there until 83 when I resigned in December of 83. But it was once that started, it was 7 days a week on call.
But did you still go to towns or go to the shows in Atlanta?
I had to be at the show in Atlanta every week. I had to go to the TV station every Saturday morning just to oversee what was going on in case something came up that I needed to take care of. A lot of things that happened behind the scenes I handled that nobody even knew I did. Something minor like getting Tim DiBiase admitted to the hospital, of course, when we dropped him on his head, and we had to get him admitted, and I had to go over there and beg and plead with a doctor to admit him and got him in, and, you know, things like that. But it was the thing with Barnett was, Barnett was one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life, but Jim had no common sense. He couldn't adjust the color on his own TV. There's a lot of people like that. So, he's actually had me stop by his house on the way home from the town to adjust the color on the TV because he couldn't do it. He had knocked it out of whack or something. That was my life. I mean, wrestling becomes... It wasn't just a job. It was your lifestyle.
Right.
If that makes sense. For me, it was being at the office 5 days a week, being at the TV station a couple hours on Saturday mornings, and just basically being within reach if something came up that you needed me. Once we started running the Omni on Sunday nights, it really became 7 days a week, more so even than before. But it was what it was, and I enjoyed it, and I'd go back and do it all over again. I'd do it a little different now if I knew the same stuff I knew now, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. I mean, I'm the most blessed individual on the planet. I got kids that grew up with me that wanted to play ball for the New York Yankees or the Atlanta Falcons or whatever. None of them ever made it. All I ever wanted to do was be in the wrestling business, and I was very fortunate to be able to do it.
Now, I know Barnett was the world champion. How involved were you with that? Were you making travel arrangements for Harley?
No, he made his own travel arrangements. Okay. He took care of that. All Barnett did was actually book the champion. He Louise Cochran, now used to be Louise Bennett. She did all of Jim's typing. She was his secretary is not the right word. She was his stenographer, clerk. She did a lot of the typing for Jim. When I would do a lot of the paperwork, I would help get the little directory published every year and make sure that it was mailed to the members. And I kept the checkbook for the NWA when the promoters would pay the percentage where they had the champion, and I did that sort of stuff. So I actually drew a check. I was paid $50 a week by the National Wrestling Alliance to keep their books. So I did that. That was just part of my job there. But Jim, most of the NWA stuff Jim handled from home. He didn't do a lot of that stuff at the office.
Now, Jerry, how about you? So let's start with when you were at home in Georgia. How did your day run?
In Georgia?
Yes.
Like Robbie said, it wasn't just a job. It, you know,
what?
Well, and what kind of offering you still recognize today in the passport to get allowed at restaurants and stuff?
Anyhow, you're consumed by it. I mean, not that it was a bad thing. It was, you know, that was your life. You know, Monday mornings, depending where I was, I could always go and work out. I got like four workouts in a week. You know, if I was in Augusta Monday night, making Tuesday night, I'd go to Augusta and come back home. And I'd sleep till I'd wake up. And if I was in just Macon Tuesday night, I'd hit the gym again, you know, the next day. So I got to work out a lot here in Georgia. And I was home, you know, I only spent the night out like once a week here in Georgia. But it was easy territory, but you're still consumed by it. I mean, you know, on the way, if you're riding with somebody, you know, you're wrestling who tonight, you know, you're going over in your head who you're going to wrestle, what kind of match you're going to have with him, or, you know, on the way home, you're talking the same thing, what kind of match you had, what you could have done, should have done. It was almost 24 hours a day. I mean, really. And it was a good thing for me because, like Bobby said, that's what he wanted to do, and that's what I wanted to do. And the traveling never bothered me. I didn't care about the traveling, even though when I was in Louisiana, that was just the way Louisiana was. Workouts got cut down. If you could get three workouts in a week, you were lucky. But we would find a way to get them in. But it was, you know, I look back now and it was the way it was, and I was that age again, I'd do it again. It was something that, of course, a lot of guys that got in the business and they couldn't handle the traveling. You know, they just couldn't handle the traveling. Traveling never bothered me. And then when I was in Oregon, I mean, you never spent the night out. Maybe once a month you'd have to spend the night out. And I was in the gym every day, loved that. Never had a set time when I would get up. Getting, if I got in late, or no matter when I got in, I'd just sleep till I woke up, you know, have me something to eat, get to the gym, come back, take a shower, gone again. That was my life. But when I was in Louisiana, I'd be gone, you know, usually three nights a week. But that was about getting home. I'd leave on Wednesday and come back sometime Sunday night. Be down at Homer, you know what I'm talking about.
Get home. I'll have to see if I can find somebody that remembers you in Homer.
Jerry, when you were during the time frame you're talking about, is that when they were running Savannah on Tuesdays?
Yes. Yes.
So sometimes if you went to Augusta and Savannah, that's when you'd stay over.
Right.
I know a lot of the guys went from Augusta to Savannah.
Right. And then, I'd be able to work out Monday in Columbus, and we'd leave and go to Augusta and come to Savannah. We'd get in what time, Bobby? 1:30?
Yeah, 1:30, something like that.
Something like that. Sleep till you wake up, go to Howard's Gym over here on Victory Drive, work out, go eat. They give us a late checkout, too, doesn't it?
Yep. Where did you stay at? Did you stay at the town?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd go back and come back from eating and, you know, take you another shower, pack your bag, go to the building. Then I'd go home from here. I would go back to Columbus, and we'd get home about 2:30 from here. And then Wednesday, I'd be in Columbus, not every Wednesday. Then I, you know, get to work out there Wednesday, and then, of course, Thursdays was kind of rough. You had to leave and go do Making TV, and then get to work out then. We'd either go to Athens or, let's we go, Albany, Bobby?
Yes.
And then Friday, you know, you could work out, and then you'd be in Atlanta. But if you was in Statesboro, I tell you what was tough. What was cool about Friday night, you'd be in Statesboro, and you had to be Atlanta TV Saturday morning. Saturday was, you know, you do Atlanta TV, leave there, go straight to Columbus TV, and like Bobby said, you'd either go to Carrollton or Griffin. And
now, when you were out in other territories, you still maintain a home in Columbus?
No.
But Kathy traveled with you?
Yes, she always went with me. We went to Oregon, Carolinas, Dallas, wherever we went.
And she still lets you go home to Columbus at all?
I've been home one time since I've been here. That's not home anymore.
I'm talking about all those places you went on the road, you would think she'd fall in love with someplace other than Columbus.
Well, that was my home. You know, and she never ever mentioned about coming back here. And I told her one day after we were moving, she thought we was going to move somewhere in town. She said, well, where? I said, we're going to Savannah. And in March, I'll be here 4 years. But, I mean, this is home now, you know. I'm the type person. I mean, I could live in Seattle, Washington, you know. I'm like Bobby always said, you got to be happy what you're doing and where you are, you know. And I've always tried to make myself be happy where I am and the people I'm around. And I mean, I've met so many people here and met a lot of great people, and it's just a lot of people.
Bobby, but if I got to ride along the beach every day on a three-wheeler or a golf cart, I'd be happy too, wouldn't
you? Well, hey, you know, stuff life. Somebody's got to do it.
I had some woman stop me Friday. She said, I was down by the pier. Gorgeous. It was gorgeous. It was real windy, but it was gorgeous. I was sitting there, and she said, hey, sir, how you doing today? I said, I'm doing fine, ma'am. How are you? She says, you, without a doubt, must have the best job there is. I said, I'm blessed. She said, I work in a cubicle 8 hours a day in an office. I said, I'd lose my mind. So I am. I mean, even though, like Bobby said, he got to do what he wanted to do in life, and so did I. And all the places I went, I could have never, ever gone to those places. I mean, you'd have been a wealthy man to go, you know. Now, how many people could afford to do that? I couldn't. I mean, even just in this country. I mean, how many people live in this country never seen the Grand Canyon? I mean, it's just, I was blessed, like Bobby said he was. I've been blessed, even though I got to go through what I go through in less than 3 weeks. That could have happened without doing what I did. You know, even though this is going to be kind of a scary thing to know, you're going to have your knees cut in two. But I'm not the first person that ever had it done and won't be the last, but I'll have a new lease on life. You know, I won't hurt every day and kind of looking forward to it, the rehab. I don't care about that. That's just like going to the gym to me.
Yeah.
So I'll get that done and I'll be back. But you know, if you can say, I mean, I can actually say, you know, I enjoyed nearly every day I did it. I mean, I really did. You know, so when you get hurt and you got to have surgery or something, but, I mean, that's just part of what we did. But, I mean, I feel like I got to do what I wanted to do. And I'm sure you would and Bobby would. It's what we knew you'd do it again. I mean, I really
absolutely.
There's no doubt.
You brought up earlier getting to the buildings, you know, and all that stuff. Wasn't it amazing back in our day when we would get to the building, you're in a dressing room and everything, how the last thing that anybody ever talked about was the wrestling business?
Exactly. And
unless
you know,
it was some sort of gossip or somebody was leaving the territory.
Right.
Somebody but was new to the territory. We never talked about it.
But see, like Bobby said, even when he was a young kid and I was a young kid, going to the matches, you couldn't wait to get there. And even when I was in the business, all the years that I was in it, there was still always a mystique to it, to me. That was my mindset for what I loved doing. It was a mystique to it. I don't know if you felt that way or not, Bobby. But
you know, I was just to say, you know, the majority, it's. I don't know if we really appreciated it or not, but most of the people we worked with, we liked.
The majority of
them. There was one or two, you know, that you were going to run into that you just couldn't get along with for whatever reason. But it's sort of like, I mean, I looked forward to getting to the dressing room.
I did, too.
I had more fun in the dressing room and riding with people up and down the road than I did any other time. And that's the part, I think that's the part I miss more than anything. It's just the camaraderie and you're right. You know, I mean, crap, there was always, I never learned how to play, but there was always a cribbage game going on.
I learned that and loved every minute of it.
Or somebody was playing cards or reading the paper or
sitting, you know, as much as I love being here in Georgia because that was home, you know, and you were home. Sitting in the dressing room next to Bill Dromo, him tying your socks in knots when you go to the ring.
Oh, yeah.
Hiding your shoes, hiding your bag, or
throwing your underwear to you when you're in the shower.
And, you know, most guys would play pranks, but nothing really ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, most of them didn't hurt anybody. They were just
no.
Aggravating.
More aggravation.
Yeah. But Bill Bowman summed it up better than anybody I've ever heard. He said, we just wanted to be entertained. And he said, we had to entertain ourselves. And that's the way we did it.
Yeah, I mean, you're gone a lot, you know. And I look back, and I think we talked about this one night. When everything was running, you know, there were territories everywhere. How many guys were on the road every night?
Oh, yeah.
One end, you know, some guys got home at 11 o'clock. Some guys got home at 12 o'clock. If you was in Louisiana, you got home at 4. But look how many guys are on the road. For the guys that got killed on the road, it was really a low percentage, I think.
Yeah, it was.
For the many miles that was put on every night by everybody. You think about that all over the country. There's no telling how many miles every night was done. I never worked Tennessee, but I heard they had long trips, you know, and I'm, you know, guys were flying, driving, and everything else. But it was a wonderful life.
What was it like, Jeff, you said the first time you walked into a dressing room and there's Lou Fez?
Oh, you really want to know? He told me I was wrestling him on TV in Atlanta. You don't want to know. This has got to be some kind of joke. I was scared to death. I really was. I was horrified of it.
I can imagine stuff. I remember the first time I did Dolphin TV. I walked in down there, and there's Mario Valento and Ken Lucas. And Mario Valento, I had not seen a whole lot of, but my grandfather was a big fan of his, and I heard about Mario Valento my whole life growing up. Of course, Ken Lucas was one that I grew up watching all the time. So to walk in, and there's the two of them, and then look over them, there's Bob Armstrong, and there's Ron Fuller, and people. I'm just sitting like this. am I sure I'm in the right place? Do I belong here with these people? And that was seriously what I was questioning about. Do I really belong here with these people?
Well, that's the way it was when I was in high school. Tom and Jody were here, the Assassins. You know, they had been everywhere. You know, like Bobby said, I got the Wrestling Review magazine every month, and you know, they're in it. They're in every magazine you get. And so I'd only been wrestling. I started in March, but I was just doing it like on the weekends down in Florida. Louie let me work on the weekends. So that Christmas, that December, Dickie said, we were going to come to Columbus for Christmas, you know, where my parents and all were. And he said, I'm going to get us booked in Atlanta. So he got us booked in Atlanta. And you got to remember, I'd only had March, April, May, June, August, September, probably in matches. He gets us booked in Atlanta on a Friday night. Guess who we're wrestling? He and I are wrestling the Assassins. And I never met him. I was horrified. I'd seen these guys when I was a kid, a teenager. Like, oh, my God, this can't be right, you know. And I was in awe again, you know, because I'd seen them all those years. I'm going to be in the ring with them.
And then you hook up with Tom, and he starts making all them funny noises.
It was me. What have I gotten into here, you know?
But it was like Bobby said, you know, like Bobby said, you had your idols, as a kid, you know, you said, God, I wonder what it'd be like. And I got to thinking, I'm actually fishing to do this. I was as nervous. I mean, that sounds silly now, but it wasn't silly then.
That would be no, like, it's not silly.
That would be like, I don't know who, if you was a baseball fan, like Mickey Mantle to me, mm-hmm. That would be like me walking, getting to play baseball, and Mantle's in his final years, and you walking in the Yankee clubhouse, and there's Mickey Mantle sitting there. It's like, no, this can't be. You know, it was like,
yeah.
It was the same thing for me in wrestling, you know. All these guys I've seen all these years, and I got to, like you said, Tarzan Tyler, I remember him when I was in high school and even younger. I got to wrestle him many, many times. It was just, and another thing, you know, we took being on TV every week for granted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Somebody actually asking you for your autograph.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing.
Now, speaking of that, I'm glad you said that.
You want my autograph?
No. Well, I do, but I'm going to tell you why I want it. My brother-in-law, when he was a kid, used to go to the matches. And he would get autographs. And he gave me a bunch of stuff he had. And he's marked over a lot of it. You know how kids do. They don't, you know, we didn't think it'd be worth anything. But somewhere in this stuff, I actually have a picture of you that you signed for him in a program. And I thought about this. I thought about telling you this for years. It never came up. At some point, we're going to hook up, and I'm going to have you sign something, and let's see how much has changed.
It won't be the same, I promise you.
I promise you it won't. No. But it's. I've got it here somewhere. It's like, I'll tell you something else I've got here. And this is something that I used to aggravate Ted when Ted first came here. And Ted's just a couple years older than me. I used to aggravate Ted about all the little girls wanting his autograph. I used to die. I mean, he probably got hot at me because I'd aggravate him so much. But one night I'm doing the ring announcing in a little old town somewhere, and because of all the ribbon, he gets in the ring, and he walks over to me, and he had an 8x10 picture that they had put on the back of a program, and he signed it to my friend, Ted Oates, and gave it to me. And, of course, I couldn't do nothing but stand there and laugh. But I've still got that picture.
No, you don't.
I've still got it. I've got it back here in a book somewhere. But at some point we were having a lunch, and he had told Charlie he may try to come up, and I took it with me that day to show it to him. So I've still got it. But that was in 1973, I guess. Maybe yeah, it had to be 73. But yeah, that's somewhere or another we'll hook up. I've got that. We'll see how much it's changed.
I'd really like to see it.
And I promise not to do you like Bill McMahon did Jesse James and say, I can't find the one he had, but my grandfather had this one.
Exactly.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a wonderful life. I got to meet so many, many great guys, and not only in the business but out of the business. It was a fun thing.
Yep.
Of course, you traveled more than Bobby and I did. So, what was it like the first time you walked in the Kiel Auditorium, as famous as that building was?
Oh, it was. Let me tell you, I've been to a lot of places. It was probably one of the greatest wrestling towns I've ever been in. It was unbelievable, and you got to see everybody when you went to St. Louis. I mean, guys from Dania's territory, guys who come in from Florida, you know, it was a mixture of everybody. It wasn't a crew, you know, it was a mixture of everybody. It was an unbelievable place, just the history of that building, you know.
Another one, even though the territory was not one that, well, some people like working there, turn there all the time. But you worked in Detroit. You worked in Cobo Hall. What was that like?
A lot of history there. I always wanted to go there. I was blessed and got to go there. Of course, it wasn't what I was used to, you know, coming out of the South, you know, Florida wrestling, the Georgia wrestling, the Carolina wrestling, and all that, but I got to do it, you know. It was what they did, and of course, I didn't change my style going up there. In fact, I went with Murdoch when I'd go up there, and, you know, we'd have our Louisiana matches, and it worked for us up there.
Didn't you work with Baba there?
Baba? No.
I was thinking those pictures I sent you was from a tag match with you guys. But you working here in some of them?
No, not there. I got to wrestle in the Superdome. That was a thrill. I got to wrestle in the Olympic Auditorium and Los Angeles. That was a thrill. History of that building. In fact, they were making a movie there that day. I had to go to the office on that Friday. I had to go get a wrestling license and get a physical and all that. And they were making the movie The Champ with John Voight.
Okay, yeah.
And they were in the ring. Kathy and I went and sat up on top of the Olympic and watched them do a scene there. It was awesome watching how they did that. Crowd would get up and cheer and roar. They're not making any noise. You know, they're waving.
You know what that building is now?
Huh?
You know what that building is now?
I have no idea.
It's a Korean church.
Oh, come on.
Yep.
Sure is it really?
It is. Yep.
It was an awesome building. It was awesome.
Have you met the history of that? That's where they filmed. If I'm not mistaken, they filmed scenes for Requiem for Heavyweight in the Olympic Auditorium.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of movies were done out of there, Mike. I'm sure. I'd like to know how many.
Any boxing wrestling movie, I would think, was filmed there.
But I had no idea they did a movie like that. And you would think that place would have been packed with a crowd, but it wasn't. I mean, the ringside was kind of full, where they'd be standing up hollering and cheering and waving their fists in the air, and, you know, the hands to the mouth hollering, but they're not saying a word. Oh, that's dubbed in. It's amazing.
Why didn't you go audition?
Well, I got here a little late, sir.
Oh, man. And then what was the biggest place that you worked in Japan? Budokan Hall?
Budokan, yeah, Russell Laird, yeah, that's right in Tokyo, and the biggest thrill of wrestling anywhere in Japan was in the Sumo Palace there in Tokyo. Oh, that's like a temple, you know. I mean, the history of that building.
Yeah.
So I mean, how could I have ever done all these things without being in the wrestling game, you know? It was just, and you look back and you say, where did it go? Where did it go? It seems like a flash, you know? doesn't it?
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been 30 years since I had my last match.
He had called me, it was Tuesday morning. He said, "Where were we 36 years ago tonight?" I said, "I have no idea." He said, we won the All-Asian Tag Team title in Tokyo 36 years ago tonight. Has it been that long? You know, you look back, my God.
Wouldn't you love to have video of all that?
Yes.
Jeez.
But all that for granted, see? You could have got your hands on some of all that stuff. Easy. But, like I said, you thought it'd never end.
That's true.
It ended with a pain.
You ever get you? What was the steakhouse that everybody got the jackets from?
Ribeiro's.
Yeah.
I still got some stuff from there.
People are always on the internet looking for those jackets. I don't know where they can get one.
Go to Tokyo and get one. That's what it
is. Oh, man. All you missed was Australia and New Zealand.
I remember Ted telling me when the first time he went to Japan, when he came back, we were talking. We were sitting in the dressing room somewhere when we were talking, and I said, "Well, what was it like?" And he said, "Well," he said, "you're excited to go." He said, "But when you get there," he said, "you get off the plane," he said, "and all these little short people are talking, and you can't understand nothing they're saying, and you realize you're there by yourself." He said, "It's a strange feeling."
It is that. I know I was there one time, and that's when we went to Korea, and me and Butcher and a guy from Australia, Johnny Gray, went to Korea. So on the plane, I asked Joe, I said, "You speak Korean? How are we going to get around over here, man?" He said, "No, me same as you. You know no Korean." That was a weird place, man. I was glad to get out of there. Had martial law, get down the street after 12 o'clock and all that. You know,
Remember Dromo telling me going to India. He said that was the strangest place he ever went.
You know, Cochran went there too, Daryl Cochran.
Yeah.
I always wanted to go there. But I never made that run either. But
I mean, they drew some hellacious crowds there.
Don't you know they did?
Didn't Butcher Rashawn say when he was on with us that he drew one of the cards he worked on had 125,000 people there?
Something like that.
Ooh, I can't imagine.
That guy on the scene drew some scratch over there, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Can you imagine being a heel and getting 125,000 people mad at you?
Not me, brother. I like to think I'm kind of tough, but I ain't that tough.
Listen, Bubba, as a referee, I've come out of that ring and thought that dressing room was 5 miles away. I can't imagine.
No, I can't. You know, it's one of some boys I got killed overseas in places like that, you know?
Ooh.
Talked to Root when he was in Baghdad.
It's like working in Puerto Rico. I'm glad I never wanted that opportunity. I always wanted to go to Australia and Japan, but I was never interested in going to Puerto Rico.
I made that trip one time, there for a week, and never went back.
Well, they tell me that Rocket told me that's the only place he's ever been where they stand outside and sell rocks.
Did you go there when Ann was sending guys down there? Tom was sending guys, Bobby?
No, I never went. I mean, I knew the guys were. I mean, the guys were going because Cologne and Jovica and you know those guys were coming over here and working. You know, we were swapping talent, but the deal was supposedly Ann and Cologne were going to be partners and blah 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 blah. But you know, I mean,
well, I had a heck of a run. So some guys had better, some didn't have as good, and but for me, I was satisfied.
You were were a good talent, sir. You were a very good talent.
Thank you very much. I tried to be.
You should have gone further than you did, but.
Well, I got off the road. I got off the road probably a little too soon, you know. Rode full time, you know, and but I did a lot of wrestling after I got off the road full time. I mean, I was going somewhere every week, you know, be gone 2 or 3 days and come back. But it worked out. I got to open my gym. I had my gym for 25 years and still wrestling and teaching wrestling. And
did you have that gym 25 years?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Sure,
I had no idea it was that long.
It was good to me.
Very what a
good.
Great spot that was.
Yep.
I mean, just you talk about atmosphere. Did you ever get to the gym over there, Michael?
No.
Just, I mean, it was you know, and Jerry had what he wanted. I mean, you know, you got the European health spas down the street or the whatever the health spa down the street, but Jerry had a gym. And, I mean, you went in there, buddy, and if you went in there and worked out, I mean, those guys went in there and broke sweat. It was he had the ring set up in one little corner of his gym over there, and he just had a neat setup.
It was good. I never thought it'd grow into that, and it did. And then, just like everything else, you know, they started opening up Gold's Gyms, World Gyms, and that town wasn't big enough for all big gyms there and the spas, and it thinned it out for everybody. And I, you know, but it was a lot of fun. It was.
Didn't you have some equipment that Rock Hunter built for you?
Yes, I did.
I thought you did.
I sure did. I went up to Carrollton and got. He made me two sets of cable crossovers. He sure did. They were. I had them forever. I had them till the very end. I sold them. And then I got to, I could weld anyhow. And so I started making my own equipment. And then, you remember Rick Farrar?
Yeah.
He was going to open a gym in Alexander City, Louisiana. And I told him I'd make some equipment. And he'd been by my gym a time or two. And I made him 13 pieces of equipment in 13 days. He drove a U-Haul there and picked it all up and went back. And I heard he had a fantastic gym there. Of course, he died. You know, I don't know how long he had the gym before he passed away. But I made a lot of equipment. Made a lot of it.
I just realized he passed away.
Yep. He's been there quite a while, Mike.
What happened to the ring that you had there in the building in the gym?
That's a good question. What did I do with that ring? Bobby, that's not the ring Ted had when he tried to open my wrestling school. That wasn't. You know, to be honest with you, I don't know. I think I sold it.
Did you know the history of that ring? You know, you know, the ring came out of the back of the sports arena. You know, y'all came up there and I showed y'all where it was. Was you with him on that trip? I can't remember.
Yeah.
I know Ted came, but I can't remember. Do you know the history of that ring?
Not really.
That was the ring. It was at Channel 11 in Atlanta. And it was the first ring we took to Channel 17 when we moved from 11 down to 17. That's the one me and Larry moved in the middle of the night.
Did Eddie make that ring?
You know, I don't know who made it. I don't
it
know who made
ring.
It. When I started working for Charlie and we started putting the ring up, or I started putting it up with Larry, that was the ring that was there. So I don't know who made it. But if you remember
ring.
How low it was to the floor, it was built for TV.
Yes, it was a good ring.
The oil
Very
was a great
good.
Ring.
Very good ring.
Great ring. But, yeah, that's where that ring came from.
And what happened to it, Bobby? I think somebody, I didn't need it anymore. My wife, I took it and moved it to another part of the building, another completely different section of the building. And then my wife wanted to use that for an aerobics room, and I sold it. I can't remember who bought it. Cannot remember. Just don't remember.
Did you have it when you were running down there?
No, I had the ring that was here in Savannah. My father-in-law gave me that ring before he passed away. I took it. one that stayed at the Civic Center here.
Was it a 20-footer?
No, it was 18.
When we bought, Mr. Newman built two rings. This is going back now to 1970, late 72, early 73. Charlie sent me to Savannah to go down there and look at them. Matter of fact, I think me and Larry went down there and looked at them because he said, go down there and see what you think. And he had built an 18-footer and a 20-footer. And we brought we bought both of them, brought the 18-footer back to Atlanta. It's what we used in the auditorium for a long time. And that 20-footer we left there in Savannah. That's why I was wondering if that was it. Because that Civic Center was so blame big, man, a 20-footer, you needed a 20-footer in that building.
Yeah. Another one I got. Was I don't know what happened with that ring. The one I had was an 18-foot one. You know, Ron built all those rings.
No, I didn't. I didn't know who built them.
He built them.
Okay.
They used the concept that Eddie had.
Three across, and then what?
Yes.
Ten the other
yes.
way, something like that.
Yes. That is correct.
And they use that 2-inch tube steel.
You remember, that
yeah,
was it.
Got the flat ends on them, and they squared them off.
Yes.
Yeah, same deal.
That's what they were.
Yep. And he always, the thing I liked about his rings, he always built those side rails out of a piece of, I don't know what you, it's like
it's
a U-shape.
It's called, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's a U-shaped piece of metal that he built the flat side in. But he always run a little rod down and run it the length of it so that it served as a handle. You could turn it over, and when you toted it and the weight side was down, it was very easy to load and unload and put up and take down.
Exactly. I know exactly what you're talking about. They put them in roofs, in the ceilings and buildings.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never built a ring. Never built one.
Dickie built the two rings that Dickie built that he made, that he had the metal poles, and he built them out of wood.
Yeah, I didn't like those rings.
They were great rings, but they were hard to put up and take down, man. They were a pain to handle.
I know they were.
They were a pain to handle. And the first one he built, he used it to, we were running the National Guard Armory there in Columbus before we got the big building. And the first time I ever saw him, got there early, watched him put it together. He was teaching me how to put it together. He had a rosewood floor on that thing. He didn't put 2x4s. They were 1x6 planks.
Right.
And he put a rosewood floor on that thing.
Really? Yeah.
It was great. Once he got it, it was a great ring. But man, you went through some wood with it because those planks would break.
Yeah. Those rings were hard too.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, eventually we put one in after Ann went out of business, one of those rings, Mr. Ward got in Columbus, and I went down there and put a plywood floor on it. I set it up in the corner of the auditorium, way back there by that roll-up door, and I put a plywood floor on it.
Yeah, so the plywood floors made the best ones.
Yeah, it actually made the ring a little better, I thought, but...
Only thing about those 18-foot rings, Bobby, you had to get 8x10 plywood.
Yeah.
You couldn't find that just
It was
anywhere.
Hard to find. We had a company here in Atlanta called Anderson McGriff, and they would stock it for us because they knew we were going to buy it.
Yeah, I'd have to order it, special order it.
The ring in Atlanta, if you remember that old ring at the auditorium in Atlanta, it was 24.
What was the floor ring in that?
That was like working in a house.
I hated those rings. What was the floor in that?
It was plywood. We had to buy 12-foot pieces of plywood. There again, Anderson McGriff would order it for us. We'd have to pay for it up front to get them to order it, and then they'd store it for us till we needed it.
Yeah, who needs that, right?
Yeah.
That stuff was heavy, too, wasn't it?
Three-quarter inch,
right.
4x12 exterior grade plywood.
I can't imagine working in a 24-foot ring.
That ring in Atlanta was 20. They used it there for 100 years. Jerry's talking about the first time he worked in Atlanta, he was in that ring because it was there forever. Benny Massey, who was the maintenance man at the City Auditorium, worked for City of Atlanta. The office paid him to put it up and take it down because that ring was so big you had to do it with a forklift. It was a pain. And then we took it out of there and we put that 18-foot ring Mr. Newman had built or Ron had built, we put it into the building there, and that's what we started using.
Those were the days.
I'll have to be perfectly honest with you, though. If I never put another one up, it won't bother me.
No. No, it's just not what people think.
Oh, man. You take all that training and come put up a circus tent.
I can see me and Bobby put that up.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go under it.
Yeah, they don't want me stringing up that high wire for them to work on either.
Oh, sir.
Oh, man.
So what you got? You got till the November 20th, Thanksgiving's when y'all shut down, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, the weekend. We usually close down the weekend after Thanksgiving. I'm not sure. I'm hoping, I'm keeping my fingers crossed and hoping I get one more town after this so I can go another month or so. End of November anyway, but there's, let's see, before I finish up, there'll be, well, Ron finishes up this weekend in Pensacola, and I'm sure he'll go to Florida. There's, behind him, there's one other guy in Dundee, and two other guys in Louisiana. I'm at the end of the trail. From here, they go to Tom Jr. in Panama City. And then we start down into Florida proper to finish up the season. I'm hoping there's enough time to go down to where I get at least one more. I'm not ready to come off the road just yet.
Well, maybe you get another gig.
I hope so.
What's it? Yeah, I do too. Otherwise, I'll be at the spending my time between whatever that high school my daughter lives in and the Simmons Inn in Jackson. Because I am not ready to go back to Mobile, Alabama.
Let me give you this shot, Jerry. Michael's daughter is living. The high school that I went to here in Atlanta, they put the building on the National Register of Historic Places, so the building could not be torn down, but it had not been used in a school in a number of years. They have turned it into condos and apartments. So Michael's daughter is now living in the high school gym where I took gym class and wore my little smelly shorts at.
Isn't that something?
Yep. When you go in there, the floor is still painted with the basketball. And I told her, I said, you need to get you at least, because her apartment, the ceilings are about 20 feet tall. They still got the skylights. One wall of her that overlooks the kitchen great room still has the skylights in it from the gym. Her bedroom has the top step of the bleachers in it. I said, you need to get you at least a Nerf basketball goal or something to put up there.
Jeez. I spent 5 years trying my best to get out of that place. I really don't see me wanting to go back over and live.
It's nice.
I'm glad for you to go to, wasn't it?
I'm sure they were.
I could see living in a place like that. But anyway... Well, guys, we are down to the wire, so probably didn't have a subject or a guest tonight, but I enjoyed this. I did too. I miss talking to you guys on Thursday. I swear it seems like we've been gone a month.
It does.
And I don't know if I mentioned this last month, but do you guys realize last month was our 2-year anniversary of the three of us doing this together?
You kidding me?
Nope. We've been doing this for 2 years.
All them people took the under on 2 years had to pay up.
That's right.
I know I've said this before, but this is the truth, fellas. I did everything I could to get out of doing this. When I was asked about it, I said, I ain't got time. I don't know. And I'm going to tell you, this has become my wife is sitting here, and she'll tell you this. This has become the highlight of my week. I so look forward to this. And the Thursdays that we're off, I mean, I walk around here with nothing to do. I really do. I enjoy this. This is a great part of my week here, and I appreciate you guys. You just don't know.
It is me, too. I just sometimes I draw a blank on what for us to talk about or try and get somebody home with us. But we've proven we do just as well.
We can add Lib.
But anyway, guys, I enjoyed it as always, and we'll get together next Thursday night, and we'll see what we can do next Thursday night to get in trouble or get out of trouble or whatever.
That sounds good, guys.
Sounds like a winner.
All right. Well, good night, everybody. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.